Recorded Books is pleased to present the Modern Scholar Series, where great professors teach you. My name is Richard Ferrone, and I'll be your host. Today, we begin a course entitled Fundamental Cases, the 20th Century Courtroom Battles That Changed Our Nation. Your instructor is Alan M. Dershowitz, who has been described by Newsweek as the nation's most peripatetic civil liberties lawyer and one of its most distinguished defenders of individual rights. Professor Dershowitz has been a pioneer in making the legal profession accessible to the general public. He is the author of 20 nonfiction works and 2 novels. More than 1 million of his books have been sold worldwide. Professor Dershowitz has published hundreds of articles in magazines and journals, and has written more than 1,000 op-ed articles. Over the course of his 35-year career as a lawyer, Professor Dershowitz has won more than 100 cases. He takes half of his cases on a pro bono basis, and continues to represent numerous indigent defendants and causes. He has been a consultant to several presidential commissions, and has testified before congressional committees on numerous occasions, including as a witness against President Clinton's impeachment. He has advised business leaders, presidents, United Nations officials, prime ministers, governors, senators, and members of Congress about legal and political issues. And now we begin Fundamental Cases, the 20th Century Courtroom Battles That Changed the Nation. Lecture 1, The Scopes Trial.
The Courtroom Trial. It has fascinated human beings from the beginning of recorded history. Most young children recall the trials of the Bible, God putting Adam and Eve on trial for eating the forbidden fruit, Cain being put on trial for murdering Abel, Abraham defending the sinners of Sodom with God being the judge, the trial of Jesus, perhaps the most famous trial in Western civilization, the trial of Susanna and the elders, of Thomas More. Everybody knows about some trials. Trials are theater. Trials are history. In this course, I'm going to use the great trials of the 20th century to try to give us a unique window into the American history of the 20th century, and indeed through the beginning of the 21st century. I'm going to use trials that many of you will have heard of, trials that some of you probably will be introduced to for the first time, to give you a sense of the period, but also a sense of the enduring commitment of America to law. It was Alex de Tocqueville who, when he visited the New Republic for the first time, said that America is a unique country when it comes to law. Every great issue eventually comes before the courts. And so we're going to look at history through the prism of the trial, the lawyers, the judges, and most important, the litigants. Because the trial presents usually a snapshot of what's going on at a particular point in time in our history. And what's a great trial? If you ask people today to define what is the great or important trial, they'll probably tell you the trial of the moment, the trial of Scott Peterson, the trial of O.J. Simpson, whatever happens to catch the fancy of the moment. But those trials are often not enduring. To make a trial a great trial for purposes of this series of lectures, I'm going to focus on trials that both reflect important and dramatic aspects of the history of the time, but also trials that have an enduring importance. For example, the first trial we're going to look at is the Scopes Monkey Trial. It took place a long, long time ago, and yet, as I'm delivering this lecture today, there is a trial in a courtroom in the United States in which intelligent design is on trial. Several years ago, creationism was on trial. It's impossible to understand the current trials without looking back in time to the famous Scopes monkey trial. So let's begin with that trial. And it's set between the two world wars. And during that period of time, American history was marked by a fundamental change in the attitudes of many, many Americans. We were quickly changing from a Christian country, often a fundamentalist Christian country, to a country based on reason, science, progress, and the Enlightenment. Inevitably, there was going to be a clash. And the clash took place in a courtroom in Tennessee when the state legislature decided to ban the teaching of Darwin's evolution. What was Darwin's evolution? It was a simple scientific theory which had espoused the development of human beings, their evolution from single-celled creatures to other more complex creatures and ultimately to the human beings that populate the world. But the Bible describes the beginning of mankind very differently. In 6 days, God created the world, and human beings were part of his creation. They were created fully formed. There's no evidence of evolution in the Bible, and there's no suggestion of any kind of change. The fossil record is unexplained by the Bible. And so there was a science teacher, an obscure science teacher in Tennessee, who wanted to teach evolution. He had learned evolution in college, and he felt an obligation to his students to teach evolution. The problem was, to teach evolution in Dayton, Tennessee, in 1925, was a crime punishable by fine and imprisonment. Now, the person who tried to conduct the class in teaching evolution, John Thomas Scopes, he fully understood that he was risking the wrath of the prosecutor and could conceivably be prosecuted for the crime of teaching. But he remembered Socrates and all the great teachers that had come before him and decided it was his obligation as a teacher to teach the truth and not to in any way become submissive to the powers of the law. Although Scopes figures heavily in the trial, as do the two major lawyers who were national figures, this is not so much a trial about people as it was a trial about issues. What was on trial was the Bible, or more specifically, the fundamentalist reading of the Bible. And many of us know the story of the Scopes trial from having either seen the movie or the play Inherit the Wind. It was a great movie. It was a great play. To personalize, it was the first play I had ever seen on Broadway, and it's part of what led me to become a lawyer. And when I saw the play, it was a clear clash of good versus evil. On the one side were the fundamentalists who described creation in a way that clearly defied what science had taught us over the last 100 or so years, and that side was led by William Jennings Bryan, a great populist, a man who would run for president of the United States on the Democratic Party ticket. He had made his famous speech about "Do not crucify America" on a cross of gold. He had opposed the gold standard because it was favorable to the wealthy and unfavorable to the poor. And he was a hero of many people in the United States, including my own grandparents, who had been immigrants and had come over here and saw William Jennings Bryan as somebody who represented their interests, the interests of poor immigrants rather than the interest of the large corporation. But this time he was on the side of the Bible and on the side of, at least many people thought, a fundamentalist reading of the Bible, and he thought there was no place for the teaching of evolution in the school systems, in the public school systems. On the other side was another crusading hero, Clarence Darrow, the man who represented labor and the man who represented the people, the man who was always opposed to corporate corruption, the man who was to represent the two defendants in the case involving Leopold and Loeb, two people from Chicago who did a thrill killing and killed one of their friends. He was a household name. Both lawyers were household names. The judge was an obscure figure from Dayton, Tennessee, and Scopes was an obscure figure. But the media descended on Dayton, Tennessee, and many of the most famous journalists of the day also became involved in the case and decided to cover it for their newspapers. And again, it was a clash between the light of science and the darkness of the old days of biblical fundamentalism. At least that's the story that has come down over the ages. Now, I've discovered over reading many, many, many years of transcripts, and this is a theme that will run throughout these lectures, that often truth is more interesting than the fictional gloss that is often placed on trials by the media. The Scopes trial has been presented through the vehicle of Inherit the Wind as fundamentalism versus progressive attitudes. But when you really look at the transcript of the trial, a somewhat different and more complicated story emerges, and a much, much more interesting story. William Jennings Bryan was no fool. He was no literal fundamentalist. He was a man who had very, very strong reasons for opposing the teaching of evolution in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925. What we often forget is that the school system in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925 was completely segregated. Blacks were in separate schools and whites were in separate schools. And Scopes was teaching in an all-white school. And he was teaching from a textbook which presented Darwin's theory of evolution in a very skewed manner. I actually went and got the textbook and have a copy of it. It's called Hunter's Civic Biology. The very title suggests that it's more than about biology and evolution. It's about civic biology. Civic represents governmental policies. And therefore, it was all about what the government should do in response to the realities of evolution. The book itself was a dangerous application of Darwin's theory of evolution. It explicitly accepted what has come to be called the naturalistic fallacy. In other words, the fallacy that says that moral conclusions can be drawn directly from descriptions of nature. And the book repeatedly drew implications for civic society from mischaracterizations of Darwin's evolution. For example, in discussing the five races of man, the textbook, Civic Biology, assured the all-white, legally segregated high school students that were taught by Scopes that, quote, the highest type of all, the Caucasians, are represented by the civilized white inhabitants of Europe and America. The book, the avowed goal of which was the improvement of the future of the human race, then proposed certain eugenic remedies. After a discussion of the inheritability of crime and immorality, the author of the book, Hunter, proposed the following analogy. Quote, just as certain animals or plants become parasitic on other plants or animals, certain families have become parasitic on society. Not only do they do harm to others by corrupting, stealing, or spreading disease, but they are actually protected and cared for by the state out of public money. Largely for them, the poorhouses and the asylums exist, continued the quote. They take from society, but they give nothing in return. They are the true parasites, end quote. From this flawed analogy grew the even more dangerous remedy. Quote, if such people were lower animals, we would kill them off to prevent them from spreading. But then the book says humanity will not allow us to kill them off. But we do have the remedy of separating the sexes in asylums and other places and in various ways preventing intermarriage and the possibility of perpetuating such a low and degenerate race. Guess who they were talking about. Remedies of this sort, it claims, have been tried successfully in Europe. He's talking about Germany now, which was in very much the frenzy of eugenics, and are now meeting with success in this country. These remedies, he said, included involuntary sterilizations, and of course we now know they eventually laid the foundation for involuntary euthanasia of the kind practiced in Nazi Germany. And these views were not limited to the textbook that was being used in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925. Similar views were being held at the very same time by eminent institutions of higher learning, including, indeed, and especially, the university that I teach at today, Harvard University. At the time, it had a racist president named Abbot Lawrence Lowell, and he was a strong believer in eugenics and in forms of euthanasia that could improve the race and turn it essentially more Caucasian and more like he was and his friends were. Even so, distinguished a Supreme Court Justice as Oliver Wendell Holmes upheld a mandatory sterilization statute on the basis of a pseudoscientific assumption about the inheritability of insanity and mental retardation. His widely quoted rationale that, quote, three generations of imbeciles are enough was later cited by Nazi apologists for mass sterilization. It's interesting, too, that one of the journalists who followed the Scopes trial and reported on it, and indeed paid for part of the defense, was H.L. Mencken, a famous journalist, the editor of the Baltimore Mercury, and himself a racist. He didn't deny his racism. He proudly proclaimed it. He called himself, as did Lowell, a racialist. But the extra couple of letters doesn't change the meaning of what they really were. They believed very strongly that racial differences mattered and wanted to prove that at this trial as well as in the general public opinion of the day. So it shouldn't be surprising to anybody who understands the career of William Jennings Bryan that he would not favor the teaching of this kind of abuse and misuse of evolutionary theory to segregated schoolchildren in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925. He thought it was wrong. He thought it was wrong morally, and he also thought it was wrong religiously. Interestingly, the only justice who dissented from the mandatory sterilization decision rendered by the United States Supreme Court was also a deeply religious man, the only Catholic on the Supreme Court at the time. And because Catholic teaching was against sterilization, even sterilization of the unfit, he decided to dissent in that case. So there was a very strong view held by many moral people that evolution, that social Darwinism at least, was being misused. Now, that doesn't mean that evolution should be banned in the school. Of course not. It did mean, however, that evolution should not be viewed uncritically in all of its applications and misapplication. Now, William Jennings Bryan was not a know-nothing literalist, not the person he's portrayed as in the movie Inherit the Wind or the play Inherit the Wind. In fact, in many respects, and this is going to be surprising to a lot of people, he got the best of Clarence Darrow, because Clarence Darrow knew nothing about the Bible. He was an acknowledged atheist and despised biblical teachings and really was not very knowledgeable about the Bible. The interesting side point is that Clarence Darrow decided to call as one of his witnesses in the case a leading expert in the Bible, none other than William Jennings Bryan. And that's what made for the dramatic courtroom fireworks. Imagine a lawyer calling his opposing lawyer to the witness stand as his own expert on the Bible. But that's what Clarence Darrow, who was always known for his kind of judicial chutzpah, his willingness to do things differently and to provoke the system, that's what he did. And he called William Jennings Bryan to the witness stand and he said, "You claim to be an expert in biblical interpretation? Fine, now you're my expert. Answer my questions." And he really expected to completely befuddle this fundamentalist fool, this literal interpreter of the Bible, and he asked him a lot of questions. For example, "Do you think the earth was made in 6 days? After all, the Bible says that in 6 days God created the earth, and on the seventh he rested. The Ten Commandments say, therefore, the seventh day shall be unto you a day of rest." But Bryan did not fall into the trap. His actual answer was not 6 days of 24 hours. He then proceeded to suggest that each of these days were really periods or epochs, and that creation may have taken 6 million years or 600 million years. Now, that doesn't make for such interesting movie making or such interesting drama on the stage, but that's the reality. When Clarence Darrow questioned William Jennings Bryan about the biblical story of Joshua ordering the sun to stand still, he obviously expected Bryan to claim that the sun orbited around the earth, as the Bible surely implies, and as most people in the world believed up through the Middle Ages. You'll remember that various famous scientists were subject to the Inquisition and to imprisonment, Galileo predominant among them, for espousing the heliocentric theory of the universe, or at least of our planetary system, that the sun was at the center and that the earth revolved around it, which violated the teachings of the church during that period of time. But Bryan was no fool, and Bryan was no believer in the geocentric theory. He didn't believe that the sun revolved around the earth. He believed the earth goes around the sun. He then proceeded to explain why the divinely inspired author of the account about Joshua and the sun stopping, why the account of that author, quote, may have used language that could be understood at that time. All in all, if you read the transcript of the actual trial of Scopes in Tennessee in 1925, it shows Bryan doing quite well defending himself, while it is often Darrow who comes off quite poorly, in fact, as something of an anti-religious bigot, or at least an anti-religious cynic. Now, Bryan won the case. It wasn't so hard for him to win the case. After all, this was being tried in Dayton in 1925 in a place that was frequently called the buckle of the Bible Belt, the center of religious fundamentalism. But sometimes winning a case doesn't give you the historical verdict of history. Eventually, the historical verdict for many, many years went against the banning of evolution in the schools in Dayton. And if you asked people who won the case, most people would probably tell you, oh, of course, Clarence Darrow won the case. He was much better than William Jennings Bryan. They forgot that the verdict went against Clarence Darrow and in favor of William Jennings Bryan, and that the teaching of evolution was, in fact, banned. Scopes literally had to pay a fine and had to stop teaching evolution in the school, lest worse befall him. He could actually have been imprisoned. Years later, the Supreme Court of the United States, in an aside, essentially, overruled that verdict and said you could not ban the teaching of evolution or ban the teaching of any kind of science in the school. Now, of course, what's happened recently is that religious fundamentalists have gotten much, much smarter. They don't want to ban the teaching of evolution. What they want to do is simply criticize it, question it. And so in some school systems around the country now, stickers have to be placed in the school books that teach evolution, saying essentially, look, students, evolution is not a fact. It's just a theory. And you should view the teaching of evolution with an open mind and consider alternative explanations. Well, what are these alternative explanations? Plainly, what the people who put the stickers in the books have in mind is creationism, namely a variation on the theme that William Jennings Bryan was playing during the trial of Scopes in Dayton, Tennessee in 1925. Namely, the alternative to evolution is that human beings were created as human beings. They were not preceded along any evolutionary scale by ape-like figures or other figures, and they did not evolve from single-cell beings, but rather were created fully by God on a certain day of creation, approximately 6,000 years, epochs, eons ago, consistent with the Bible and consistent with modern interpretations of the Bible. There are today, of course, some literalists who literally say they can date the day on which the earth was created. It was 5,700 and something years ago. That's not mainstream, but there are some in many parts of the country who believe that. But the William Jennings Bryans of today are much smarter. They're not trying to ban evolution. What they're trying to do is include the teaching either of creationism or of this new theory called intelligent design. Now, the courts held several years ago that the teaching of creationism could not be permitted in public schools. It could be done in private schools, of course, in religious schools, but it couldn't be done in public schools under the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment to the Constitution, which prohibits any law respecting an establishment of religion. And teaching one form of religious view of creation is a form of establishing religion. It's a form of preferring religion over non-religion, and that's prohibited. So along come the teachers of intelligent design, scientists, many of them very smart, some of them very well credentialed, and they say, tell you what we're going to do. We're not going to teach creationism. We don't know how the world came about. It's beyond our knowledge. What we do know is if you look at the logic of the universe, if you look at the logic of beings on Earth, it is far more logical and far more consistent with science to postulate a rational, intelligent design. And that rational, intelligent design is an alternative to the teaching of evolution. They both can't be true because evolution postulates randomness, postulates simply facts coming together in nature to accidentally produce changes which eventuated in the evolution of human beings, of horses, of sharks, of camels. And the intelligent design theory says, no, that's not the way it happened. There was a designer. We're not telling you who it is. We're certainly not ever going to mention the G word, because the G word, God, would get us in trouble with the Supreme Court. So instead we use the ID word, the neutral term, intelligent design. And intelligent design leaves open the possibility that the intelligent designer could have been an alien from a distant planet. My friend Robert Nozick, the great philosopher, once said that the Earth could have been the product of a science project by a seventh grader in a distant galaxy, and I added, for which he got a B-. And you can always postulate extraterrestrial intelligent design. Of course, that's not what the intelligent design people have in mind. They want you to assume that it was done intelligently and that there was a designer, and then for you to make the leap from intelligent designer to God, to the Christian God or the Judeo-Christian God or the God of the Bible or the God of the book of Genesis without allowing you to say that. And so now these issues are again before the court. And we will see some great cases in the 21st century challenging the alternative way of trying to introduce religion into the curriculum, not by banning evolution as was tried in the Scopes trial, but by presenting evolution simply as a theory and presenting intelligent design as an alternative theory. Of course, you could then say, why not present the geocentric theory of the world, that the Earth is at the center, as an alternative theory? Why not present alchemy as an alternative theory? Why not present astrology as an alternative theory to astronomy? So far, the intelligent design people have not pushed in that direction, but they have pushed very hard in the direction of preventing the teaching of evolution alone without it being compared to the alternative theory of intelligent design. So, what does the Scopes case teach us in terms of what is likely to happen if this case were to be presented to the United States Supreme Court? Hard to know, because it's hard to know how the justices themselves today think about the Scopes case. And even those who think that the Scopes case came out wrong, that is, the banning of evolution was a mistake, might today take the view that banning evolution is very different from teaching it as a theory and trying to introduce an alternative to it. So, although I think you can learn much from looking at the past, and perhaps the past is one of the better predictors of the future, As Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, the great judge who made the mistake of sustaining sterilization ban, but as he once said, the job of the lawyer is to predict what the courts will do in fact. And that's my job as a lawyer and as a law professor. I try very hard to predict what the courts will do in fact. But before you can predict what courts will do, you have to not only know the history of the past, but you also have to know the personalities, you have to know the ideologies, you have to know the views of the judges who sit on the courts. In the old days, judges would wear wigs and robes, and they were made to all look the same because judges were supposed to be the embodiment of the law, of the impersonal law. The expectation was if you put down 100 judges in the same room, they would all come out the same way because the law is the law is the law. Legal realism, I think, has overtaken that theory, and we now know that the law is what the judges say it is. And modern judges might very well uphold the teaching of intelligent design in the public school, even though they didn't uphold the teaching of creationism in the public school. So it's not possible to know for sure, A, how a Scopes case currently would come out, and B, even if a Scopes case would come out differently today than it did in 1925, how the modern variations of the Scopes cases would come out. So I think the Scopes case is a very, very important exercise both in legal history and in American history in general, and also in understanding how courts work. It helps us understand the period of time between the Second World War and the First World War. It helps us to understand the clash between biology on the one hand, represented by evolution, and religion on the other hand, represented by the book of Genesis. It helps us to explain what was going on in America during that period of time, a period that followed massive immigration of different groups into this country. We were, before the beginning of the 20th century, largely a white, Protestant, male-dominated country, an aristocracy in many ways. Blacks couldn't vote, women couldn't vote, and there were very, very few Catholics, Jews, Muslims, and others in the United States. The last part of the 19th century, the early part of the 20th century, opened the doors to immigration. We became a very, very different country. A very different country religiously. We became the most multicultural, multi-religious, most multilinguistic, multiracial country in the history of the world. And the 1920s was a testing period. And the Scopes case was part of that test. It juxtaposed religious fundamentalism of one kind against modernity, science, and cynicism of one kind as well. It also teaches us much about where the court is likely to go and where the courts in general are likely to go in the future. But times change, people change, the law changes. It's never static. And in the weeks to come and in the lectures to come, we will look at a lot of other cases, cases that also reflect the periods at issue, but cases that tell us something about what we face in this country today. We'll look at other cases during that period of time. We'll look at the trial of Leo Frank, the first case in which a Jew was lynched in America, and he was lynched based on the testimony of an African American. A very, very interesting interplay of race, religion, and politics. We'll look at the trials of Sacco and Vanzetti, Italian American anarchists whose religion and race played a role in their conviction. We'll look at the trial of Leopold and Loeb. We'll look at the Nuremberg trial, which eventuated, perhaps, from the misuse of eugenics and other forms of racism. We'll look at the trial of the Rosenbergs for spying against the United States. We'll look at cases like the trial of Mike Tyson, the heavyweight boxing champion of the world, for rape, the trial of O.J. Simpson, the impeachment trial against Bill Clinton. And we'll move finally into the 21st century and look at some of the major trials that our century began with. The trial of Bush versus Gore for the presidency of the United States in 2000. The Texas sodomy trial, which finally legalized homosexuality between consenting adults after years in which that was criminalized. And finally, the trials of the future, the trials involving detainees, alleged terrorists, people from Al-Qaeda, and we'll ask ourselves whether the lessons of the past will give us insights into the future. The one thing that remains clear and will remain clear throughout all of our study of trials is that the trial is very significant as a prism into the history and attitudes of a country. And as we look at the trials, we look at ourselves. As we look at the trials in America, we look at America. So I look forward to further trials, further discussions, and some good hard thinking about America and the trials that make us and the trials that challenge us.